Hello and welcome to the reading of the e-edition of The Courier. And you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. And I am your narrator, Peter Welch. All right, well, let's take a look here and see what's going on in the paper here today. Big picture here on the front page of The Courier. It says, return from deployment. I'll be home for Christmas. Well, that's great. That's fantastic. Let's see here. Let me read what it says here underneath the photo. Iowa Army National Guard soldiers of the 1133 3rd Transportation Company stand at attention as they sing the Army song at their welcome home ceremony on Saturday at the Waterloo Convention Center. The company has been deployed to Poland for 10 months in support of Operation European Assure, Deter, and Reinforce. All right, let's read the article here. It's in Waterloo. Family and friends are gathered Saturday to formally welcome home approximately 160 members of the Mason City-based 1133 3rd Transportation Company at the Waterloo Convention Center. The Iowa National Guard soldiers, some of whom have been back in Iowa since August, gathered for a ceremony marking nearly a year's deployment to Poland as part of Operation European Assure, Deter, and Reinforce. Families already have had some time to catch up with the soldiers that they love. Right off the start, it was weird being back. Before I left, we had just had a baby, and he was 3 weeks old, said Specialist Jason Rehe of Mason City. Coming back and seeing him almost 10 months old was a big change. Haley Rehe expressed her happiness with having her husband home. She said that the services that the National Guard provides for families of the deployed can be a lifeline. It's been tough. It's been tough, but I'm glad to have him home. We have 4 children, and we were blessed. They really supported us while Jason was gone. That was huge for us, Haley Rehe said. After all of the excitement, Jason Rehe is ready for a low-key holiday season. We had our big vacation as a family last weekend in the Wisconsin Dells. It was fun. We met my brother and his 3 boys there. We had a fun getaway, Jason Rehe said. Rahi's son Parker has some ideas on how he and his dad can spend time together. I like that he's able to play catch with me and coach sports, Parker said. One soldier spoke for the entire company in expressing his gratitude to be back home. It's amazing to be home, said Sergeant Andrew O'Day of Oskaloosa. Being around families and seeing friends, nothing compares to being in a foreign country for 10 months and then returning home to the United States of America. Home means a lot of things. It is amazing. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley was in attendance but did not address the gathering. He expressed his thanks before the event. I've gone both when they leave Iowa and when they come home. It's always more enjoyable when they come home. The number one responsibility of the federal government is national defense. We have a responsibility to provide you with what you need, Grassley said. Governor Kim Reynolds sent well wishes via recorded message. As governor, I consider these homecomings one of the greatest privileges that I get to share with Iowans. Reynolds' message goes on to say, the joyful reunions of families and friends are powerful to witness and important reminders that while you're supporting your nation overseas, your loved ones served here at home. All right, let's see. What else do we have here? Gallagher Blue Dorn Schools Integrating Arts Curriculum. 3-week-long arts residences add fun to Waterloo classes. Last spring, third graders at Lou Henry Elementary School spent time fracturing fairy tales through script writing and learning theater skills from playwright and educator Kiana Kutz. Third graders at Becker explored opinion-based writing with internationally acclaimed tap dancer and educator Juan Johnson. Dancer, writer, and Rethinking Schools director Sierra Jones taught fifth grade at Waterloo Lincoln Elementary School, and how to create life maps and integrate memoirs, writing with movement. These 3-week-long arts integrated residencies, were provided through the 20-year partnership, between Waterloo Community Schools and the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls. The partnership recently renewed for 2024 places an emphasis on community by through the arts in various educational settings. Defendant takes stand in attempted murder trial. Robert Lee Williams Jr. allegedly shot man in face in Waterloo. Robert Lee Williams Jr. said he was trying to calm down Tony Campbell as they talked. Williams ended up shooting Campbell in the face. Williams, 34, of Waterloo, is charged with attempted murder and other offenses in the July 31st, 2020 shooting next to the alley behind Williams' sister's West 6th Street house. Prosecutors said that Williams had suspected Campbell of poisoning his brother a month earlier. And Campbell, age 39, told jurors that he had been merely hanging out with Williams, drinking and doing cocaine, when Williams accused him of harming family members, pointed a gun at his head, and fired. On Friday, jurors got to hear Williams' side of the story as he took the stand in his own defense. Williams said that Campbell had approached him while he was outside near his sister's house in the afternoon. After driving to get drugs and alcohol, they returned to West 6th Street. Williams said that Campbell had been acting aggressive during the encounter, even flashing a pistol and staring Williams in the eye. "I'm trying to be cool and cordial," Williams testified. He said another friend, Patrick Salas, eventually pulled up, and he overheard Salas and Campbell talking about Williams' brother, who had been in the hospital from a possible poisoning. Williams said that Campbell was becoming agitated, so he offered him a sip from his liquor bottle. The offer didn't help, and Williams said he sensed something was about to go down. Campbell said he was tired of talking about what happened to the brother and was going to start shooting. According to Williams' account, Williams said that he saw Campbell reach for the pistol in his waistband. Williams said he drew his own pistol. "He's going towards the gun," Williams said. "I shot one time. He was reaching for his weapon to pull it out." Williams said that he continued firing as Campbell ran off to keep him from turning around and returning fire. "I got to protect myself," Williams said. Assistant County Attorney Brad Waltz questioned why Williams didn't tell investigators that Campbell was carrying a gun and was about to shoot during a police interview weeks later. Instead, Williams told police Campbell had harmed his brother and sister, and he admitted to police that he had tried to kill Campbell. On the stand, Williams said that he was merely telling police what they wanted to hear and was trying to keep his family from getting in trouble for the shooting. Waltz pointed out that none of Williams' relatives were charged in the incident. After the shooting, Williams said that he walked a few blocks to a friend's house and later traveled to the St. Louis areas. Jurors began deliberation in the case on Friday afternoon. All right, let's see what else we have here. Teen charged with shooting at vehicle in Waterloo. A Waterloo teen has been arrested for allegedly shooting a gun at a passing vehicle in February. On Friday, Andrew Spates III, age 18, was arrested for reckless use of a firearm, causing property damage, carrying weapons, and felon in possession of a firearm. Bond was set at $50,000. Witnesses reported seeing Spates stand outside and shoot at a black car and drove by in the area of Lynn and Oliver Streets around 5:10 p.m. on the 18th of February. No injuries were reported, but one of the bullets entered a nearby home and struck a television set in the living room. Officers found 20 spent .40 caliber shell casings. Police searched Spates' home at 2235 East 4th Street on the 27th of June and found clothing he was allegedly wearing during the February shooting, according to court records. Spates is also awaiting trial for a June incident where police found a loaded 9mm Glock 17 pistol in a car in the 1200 block of Franklin Street. Authorities said that Spates is prohibited from handling firearms because of a 2021 adjudication in juvenile court of an intimidation with a weapon charge. All right, let's see. What else? Let's go to, let's turn the page here to our next page. Now we're getting into the, the Cedar Valley section of the paper. Let's see what we have here. Supervisors, mayors approve $3.5 million dispatch budget. Elected officials from across Black Hawk County sent a nearly $3.5 million budget to keep the 911 dispatch center running next year. The Consolidated Communications Center Oversight Board, made up of seven mayors and the five members of the county's Board of Supervisors, approved the fiscal year 2025 budget for the service on Tuesday. The cost to run the center from July 1st, 2024 to June 30th, 2025 will be $154,805 more than last year. Contributions from seven cities and rural Black Hawk County are based off the taxable valuation for fiscal year 2022, which ended in June 2022. The taxable valuations for 2023 are not available as of yet. When the budget for fiscal year 2024 was decided in February, the board switched from contributions based on calls for service and population to paying based on taxable valuations. That resulted in an increase of $710,508 from the fiscal year 2023. Sarah Heliso. Tri-Pi equals success for teen employment for girls in Cedar Valley. The Pi Bakery is a slice of heaven for Sarah Heliso. As the nonprofit organization director and co-founder, she believes for the full circle moments of her young charges. I love watching them grow. I see them start unsure and not super confident. By the end, they're whipping through process, entering expenses in QuickBooks, and running reports, she said. The brick-and-mortar bakery in downtown Waterloo is a teen employment program for high school girls in the Cedar Valley area. Heliso, age 30, and her collective, Megan Tenson, hire teens to make pie as a first job experience and pair time in the kitchen. And monthly classroom workshops and mentoring, she said. The focus is on the job skill development, financial literacy, growth in faith and identity, and building friendship across community divides. In short, teens at Tri-Pi learn to manage their paychecks, prepare for future employment, understand their unique gifts, and recognize value in each other. The nonprofit website notes, I get to see how much they grow, leading their peers, saving to buy a car with cash, and skill building, Heliso says. It's just great to be a part of that. Marianne Abel Lipschutz, who nominated Heliso for 2023 Under and 40 Award, calls her an activist with an indelible vision. Heliso is humbled and surprised to be recognized for her efforts. I feel like the Cedar Valley area has so many great young people. It could have 100 under 40, she said. A Muscatine native, Heliso earned a degree in recreation, tourism, and nonprofit leadership and management from the University of Northern Iowa in 2015. She became involved with a fledgling Tri-Pi in 2014 as a volunteer with Link Christian Community Development through Orchard Hill Church in Cedar Falls. And at that time, Tri-Pi was a smaller program run through the church. My last year of college, we really got Tri-Pi going, Heliso said. I wanted to see where that went, so I stuck around. By 2015, Heliso was Tri-Pi director alongside Tenson, and by 2018, the organization had its very own storefront. Sarah is the next generation entrepreneur who leads with humility, pizzazz, joy, and expertise, Abel Limpton Schutz said. Her commitment to a diverse group of Cedar Valley teens and learning life and leadership skills through meaningful work launched her out of UNI in 2015 into an opportunity to bring change to the street. Hansel and Gretel come to Wartburg Stage. In Waverly, if you were lost in the forest and stumbled upon a gingerbread house, you might be tempted to sample a shingle. The gingerbread house on stage for the Wartburg Community Symphony family-friendly holiday performance on Saturday of Hansel and Gretel isn't edible. This one is built of wood, sheathing, styrofoam, and other materials designed to whet the audience's appetite for the fairy tale opera at 2 p.m. in Newman Auditorium on the Wartburg College campus. The Wartburg Community Symphony will be joined by performers from the Wartburg Opera Workshop, directed by Associate Professor Brian Flatsgraf, and a children's choir from St. Paul's Lutheran Church and School. Reserved seat tickets are $20 for adults and free for youth 18 and under and Wartburg College students. Available online at www.wartburg.edu/symphony. Tickets will also be sold at the door. This performance will have lots of theatrical elements. We want to make it appealing to families and to those who love the sophisticated art form of opera, said Rebecca Niederheiser, the symphony's artistic director and conductor. It's an intimate cast and an opera that first premiered 130 years ago in Germany at Christmas time. The music is lovely and involves the whole orchestra and outstanding performers from the opera workshop. It elevates both groups and celebrates a work that isn't done nearly as often as it should be, she said. The fairy tale opera was composed by Engelbert Humperdinck with librato by his sister Aldhild Wett and is based on the Grimm Brothers fairy tale Hansel and Gretel. Okay, now we're going into the Cedar Valley section of our paper here today. A communal celebration. Theme is Light Out of Darkness for Met Choral Show. In Waterloo, the Metropolitan Choral began rehearsing in September for its holiday concert, Light Out of Darkness, on Sunday. We've been working on lots of beautiful music that comes with its challenges, but we don't let difficult music interfere with the choral singing beautiful, said artistic director and conductor Ryan Osina. The concert is at 3 p.m. at First Congregational Church at 608 West 4th Street in Waterloo. Admission is free. Free will donations of cash or non-perishable food items will be collected for the Northeast Iowa Food Bank. Inspiration for the Light Out of Darkness theme was taken from several compositions the choral will perform, including Abendlied Evening Song by Romantic Era composer Joseph Reinberger. Performed in German, the lyrics are a biblical reference to the walk to Emmaus and a plea for someone to stay as nights fall, or as the night falls, I should say, excuse me. The piece is a reflection on what is the meaning of darkness. Dark can be an unknown place where we find consolation and comfort and a place of beauty and a time of wonder. Osina explained, as in the Christmas story, there's the coming of light and hope into the world, which also connects with us being able to be a light to others, to be a light in our community, he goes on to say. CV Catholic schools are awarded $450,000. Cedar Valley Catholic schools have been awarded $450,000 after a new state law providing taxpayer funding to private school students caught the eye of a foundation focused on educational innovation. The Yass Foundation for Education announced an initiative in June to give $5 million to schools in Iowa, Arkansas, and Oklahoma because all three states passed laws dedicating public funds to private schools. The states were selected for their tenacity and university in moving all families towards education freedom, and also through the new laws. Iowa's education savings accounts provide state-funded vouchers for private school tuition and other expenses equal to the per pupil and aid provided to public schools. A total of 21 schools in the three states were given the YAS Award for Education Freedom, including CVCS and eight others in Iowa. States' governors were invited to nominate up to 10 outstanding education providers who have the capacity to ramp up quickly to observe more, to serve more students, according to the foundation's website. Okay, let's continue now with Cedar Valley and Iowa, feeding the need for speed. New Grid Lounge in Cedar Falls has realistic simulation for aspiring car drivers. Racing cars grab the attention of a lot of children. Zach Everman, a 2004 graduate of Dyke New Hartford High School, was one of them growing up. Now he and two other University of Northern Iowa graduates have founded Grid Lounge, which they believe in Iowa's only simulation racing lounges in Suite 103 at 100 East 2nd Street. "I've always loved driving and have loved cars in general," he said. "I've never been racing in real life before, but I was interested in that thrill." The Cedar Falls entrepreneur had played racing video games like Forza Horizon. That wasn't enough, though. He had to scratch an itch. He had later in life a desire to take his experience to another level without worrying about risks and the cost of owning such a vehicle. "I'm not at a point where I'd pick up racing in real life with a wife and three kids," Everman said. Instead, the owner of Pixel Labs, an advertising agency a short walk away, decided 11 months ago that he'd build a simulator in the tight space under his basement stairs with a 34-inch monitor, steering wheel, set of pedals, and seat to simulate the real-life challenge. "The arcade games are not the same. The physics are not realistic," he says. "Arcades are more about engagement. Here, you feel like you're in a real car, and you're driving actual cars and racing on actual tracks." Everman used the simulator to race with people from around the world, and within a few months now, he found his niche. But he felt the experience was meant to be shared with others. So, of course, a friend or two could build their own simulators and could share in that spirit from remote locations. "It's not the same as being right next to someone and being able to heckle them," he said. So he took his interest one step further with Grid Lounge. He wanted to create a destination and see if an audience or a community could be formulated here locally. Everman Chief Executive Officer and his business partners Patrick Lusenman, Chief Financial Officer Reese Reimers, Chief Technology Officer, held a soft opening on the 24th of November during the downtown Holiday Hoopla event. "Every race has a grid to start with, and we wanted this to be an inviting space for those who don't know anything about racing," Everman said about the name selection. The business located in the Hertz Donut Building had its grand opening on Friday in a space formerly occupied by Hurling Hatchet, now its sixth, its next door neighbor. Regular open racing hours will be from 4 to 10 p.m. on Tuesday through Friday and 1 to 10 p.m. on Saturdays. Racers can make appointments or show up to see if there's a slot available to play. Members, however, will be allowed to access outside of the normal hours, potentially as early as 6 a.m. The 1,100-square-foot space has six simulators equipped with an adjustable seat, a steering wheel, pedals, and a 49-inch ultra-wide monitor. As long as a person is old enough and has legs long enough to effectively tap the pedals, They can play and choose from at least 165 different cars and 19 different tracks. The steering, the pedals, and the monitor. It's all pretty sweet. It's accessible for everyone, just challenging enough to make it fun. But it's not like something you'll never figure out, said Rob Williams of Cedar Falls, who came with his 8-year-old son, Owen, who will probably leave him in the dust. He added that it's more fun than the Wi-Fi video game console at home, and it's exciting to see Cedar Falls on the cutting edge of something like this. He mentioned Grid Lounge to a friend from Kansas City who didn't think his area had anything quite like this. There's always that turn that gets you, said Aaron Jarnigan of Cedar Falls, who was competing alongside the father-son pair. It's really addicting when you come across a new track and want to figure out how to do it well. And it's a super immersive experience. Time goes by so fast. Drivers can compete against each other in real time at the lounge or play individually. They can also show up to watch their friends over their shoulders or on the 85-inch broadcasting monitor from a high top table, couch, or ledge, allowing a group or at least a dozen or so to share in the experience together. Closed container drinks are sold. The lounge team also is working on partnerships with restaurants like Urban Pie for food ordering and drop-off. It's an exciting opportunity for Cedar Falls to have this sort of experience with a friend as a bachelor party, a corporate party, or team-building exercise, says Losing Man. It comes without any risk, and you can drive cars and be on tracks from all over the world. The offerings go much further. They include leaderboards, driver performance index calculations, and other stats. To learn more, go to online to gridlounge.co.com. A home for our history. Cedar Falls Historical Society's Education Center being built now in downtown. In Cedar Falls, the Historical Society began construction a month ago, and what Executive Director Carrie Edeldert said has been a dream for the organization for years. The former law office building at 315 Clay Street is being transformed into the Society's new education center. Once completed as early as June, the 2,300-square-foot main floor will lend visitors access to a large classroom, as well as a kitchen and a bathroom to the west. An office for education coordinator Diane Schutzbach said to the east. We pretty much gutted it and have put up the frames, said Eildertz, standing in the future classroom as workers moved about. The planners have changed from a year ago. The organization decided to break into pieces, literally and figuratively, what is a much bigger project. Leadership got a start on its vision earlier by moving forward with renovating the former office building instead of waiting until fundraising was complete for the museum, a much more expensive endeavor. And we are coming up to the half-hour broadcast of our program. It's going fast today, and I would like to remind you that you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled, and we are reading the e-edition of the Courier here today on the 5th of December, pardon me. And this is the e-edition of the paper. Okay, normally at this time, we read the obituary section of the Courier. And I don't see any news on that today. So what we're going to do is we're going to move on here with the news. So let's take a look at what's going on here in Des Moines. Iowa Democrats will have the opportunity in the state's 2024 presidential caucuses to express their preference for either of two long-shot candidates challenging incumbent President Joe Biden. The Iowa Democratic Party Leadership Committee, during its meeting Saturday, approved a plan to include former Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips and author Marianne Williamson, in addition to Biden, on the formerly first-in-the-nation caucuses by mail presidential preference cards. Iowa Democrats scrapped their longstanding system in-person caucuses for presidential preference and instead, for the first time in 2024, will gauge grassroots support for presidential candidates by selections marked on a card that will be conducted via the mail. The reform was an attempt by Iowa Democrats to address criticism of their complicated caucus system and maintain their leadoff spot in the quadrennial process of selecting U.S. presidents. While that effort failed, the National Democratic Party opted nonetheless to reorder its candidates' nominating calendar and removed Iowa from the early voting window. Iowa Democrats have proceeded with their new caucus format. Instead of gathering in school gymnasiums and organizing supporters in huddles, Iowa Democrats will simply nominate a presidential candidate via mailed preference cards. The state party at Saturday's meeting determined which candidates would appear on the cards. There had been some question whether the cards would include anyone other than Biden, since he is an incumbent president and the party's unofficial leader. With Saturday's action, the Iowa Democratic Caucus cards will include Biden, Phillips, Williamson, and an option to remain uncommitted to a candidate. There was no discussion about the candidate list during Saturday morning's meeting. When the list was made official, Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Rita Hart issued a statement saying she plans to caucus for Biden. President Biden has done more in his first 2 years than some presidents have done in two terms, and I believe he will win over 2024 Iowa caucuses, Hart goes on to say in the statement. Incumbent presidents rarely face serious challenges from within their political party during their reelection campaigns, and no incumbent president has ever lost a primary challenge. Biden finished fourth in the 2020 Iowa Democratic caucuses before going on in other states to earn the party's nomination and win that year's general presidential election. Biden finished fifth in the 2008 Iowa Democratic caucuses, which were won by Barack Obama, who then selected Biden as his running mate. Biden served as VP for both of Obama's two terms in the White House. Okay, we're now in a section of the paper, celebrations. Let me take a look and see what that is all about here. I think this is new for us. I don't remember reading a celebration section, but here, let's take a look at it anyway. Bartholomew / 50, Dean and Elizabeth Williams Bartholomew will celebrate their 50th wedding anniversary. An open house is planned from 1 to 3 p.m. on the 10th of September at First Christian Church at 1302 West 11th Street in Cedar Falls. All family and friends are invited. A light lunch will be offered. The event is being hosted by Jesse and Lee Bartholomew, and they were married on the 8th of December back in 1973 at First Baptist Church in Cedar Rapids. Oh, that's terrific. All right, let's see. What else have we got here? Battle of the Bells. There's a picture of a Salvation Army representative, ringing the bell to raise money. And it is Battle of the Bells. This is Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart smiles as Todd Wilson puts a donation in the Salvation Army red kettle for the mayoral Battle of the Bells on Saturday at Hy-Vee in Waterloo. Hart, Evansdale Mayor Dean Kobliska, Elk Run Heights Mayor Lisa Smock, and Cedar Falls Mayor Rob Green all rang bells on Saturday, attempting to raise the most money for their respective cities. The annual competition raised $6,698 for the Salvation Army of Waterloo Cedar Falls. Hart raised $3,506, and Kobliska and Smock raised $2,454, and Green raised $738. Hey, that money adds up, right? All right, what else do we have here? We got one more here. Let's see. This is also a celebration, Edelnint/50, 50th anniversary. Jay Edelnint and Vicki Van Kirk Edelnint will celebrate their 50th anniversary on the 9th of December. A card shower is planned. They were married December 9th, 1973 in Marshalltown. Congratulations, folks, for that wonderful long marriage. Okay, what else do we have here going on here in the paper today? Let's turn the page. Let's take a look. Okay, now we are in the op-ed section of the paper, opinion editorials, and I'm looking at the political cartoon, which is under my view, and I'll explain it to you. There's option A and option B. Option A says, Russia invades Ukraine, and someone in the Capitol says, send your money. Option B says, Russia wins and invades NATO, and the person again says, send your sons. Well, I think that makes its point, does it not? Okay, let's take a look at today's editorial, which is written by Mark Z. Barabak. Okay, and let's see what it says. Newsom DeSantis debate offers more heat than light. The hyped debate between Gavin Newsom and Ron DeSantis last week was never going to be more than a brief sideshow running parallel to the main attraction, the actual campaign for the White House. California Democratic governor is not a candidate for president. Florida's governor is running for the Republican nomination, but doing so poorly that he stooped to participate in a public or publicity stunt dressed up as a national policy forum that fairly reeked with the smell of DeSantis' desperation. Even by those meager standards, the great red versus the blue state debate, as Fox News breathlessly promoted the cable TV throwdown, provided a dud. You're nothing but a bully, Newsom taunted. You're a bully, DeSantis shot back. And so it went for more than 90 excruciating minutes, at least on those occasions when the two weren't talking past or over each other. A good debate, or one that's worth its while, illuminates issues and parses and differences and sheds light on the persona of its participants. Well, last week's affair was an exercise in affirmation, underscoring much of what we're already grasped to wit. Newsom and DeSantis genuinely despise each other. They have vastly different approaches and philosophies to govern their sprawling, variegated states. Fox News is a propaganda arm of the Republican Party with little pretense of fairness or balance. The evening's ringmaster, Sean Hannity, had pledged to be an ever-handed and impartial facilitator, but the oh-so-soft questions he gently lofted DeSantis left no doubt where Hannity's rooting interest lay. The blazing red tie he wore should have been a giveaway. Each segment was prefaced with a selective battery of statistics on crime, gas prices, education, homelessness that painted California as just a hair's breadth from capsizing and sliding ingloriously into the ocean. Despite that obvious advantage, it was DeSantis who seemed ill at ease, looking like a man suffering a hernia as he prepared to face a root canal. That's a lie, was his standard rejoinder. You are just jabbering, DeSantis said during another bristling back and forth. Anytime you are uncomfortable, you just make up, Newsom goes on responding. For California's governor, who loves gambling on a national stage, the whole evening was a lark. He has taunted DeSantis from long distance for more than a year, and plainly enjoyed being able to shiv him up close. A broad grin telegraphed his glee. You're trolling folks to try to get some news and attention so you can out-Trump Trump, Newsom said, referencing the commanding GOP frontrunner. And by the way, how is that going for you, Ron? You're down 41 points in your own home state. Ouch. The subplot of the evening was Newsom's supposed shadow campaign, as DeSantis called it, to wrest the Democratic nominating from the aged incumbent President Joe Biden. But California's governor was utterly slavish in the role of dutiful party soldier, repeatedly extolling Biden's performance with a rat-a-tat-tat statistics, a Newsom's hallmark on falling inflation, rising employment, and other favorable barometers. He even leapt to the defense of his old free enemy, Vice President Kamala Harris, when DeSantis mispronounced her first name, deliberately, it seems. It's K-O-M-A-L-U-H, Newsom sounded out. Madame Vice President to you. Much has been made of the showdown as a possible preview of the 2028 presidential campaign. But that contest is political eons away. Comparisons also have been made to the debate between California Governor Ronald Reagan and New York Senator Robert Kennedy, two other political celebrities who staged a similar exhibition match in May of 1967. They, too, were seen as prospective presidential rivals. But even though Reagan's performance in that sober matchup was wildly lauded, it took three tries and more than a dozen years before he finally made it to the White House. Newsom might be considered the winner from last week's debate, if there was such a thing, simply by making DeSantis show up and debate him as an equal. But it's highly unlikely that anything said or done on the red and blue themed sound stage outside Atlanta will change the trajectory of the 2024 campaign. The best that can be said is that given an opportunity to extend the forum beyond its scheduled 90 minutes, and Newsom certainly seemed eager to go on, Fox mercifully spared its audience and passed. Here's hoping for no repeat. And again, Mark Barabak is a columnist for the LA Times. Well, my goodness. Politics, politics, politics. Okay, let's take a look at something else that, of course, affects each and every one of us. And that's climate, the climate change. And this article is 70,000 are jetting to climate confab and oil country. And this is written by Mark Gungaloff. How many people do you think it takes to hammer out a global climate agreement? 500? 5,000? 50,000? Apparently, the correct answer is 70,000. That's about how many people are expected to turn up in Dubai over the next few weeks for COP28, the latest United Nations climate confab. This is up from 49,704 at COP27 last year in Egypt and 38,457 at COP26 in Scotland. Attendance has more than tripled since 2019. In COP's early years, attendance averaged just about 5,000. Whether this explosion is a sign that the world is taking climate change more seriously or just the bloat that naturally accumulates around gatherings of humans who control large pools of political financial capital still remains to be seen. It's difficult to be optimistic. Many of those 70,000 people will spend days continuing a year-long argument over whether the world should phase fossil fuels out or down, or whether those fuels should instead be abated by iffy, so far, carbon capture technology. Meanwhile, the big oil producers are still moving full steam ahead on phasing those fuels up rapidly, shrinking the window of opportunity to limit global heating to just 1.5 Celsius above pre-industrial averages. If one wanted to be nitpicky about it, One could argue that 70,000 people riding airplanes to an oil country on the Arabian Peninsula to talk about climate change feels a bit like staging an, a AA meeting or AA meeting in a Fort Lauderdale nightclub during spring break. You risk losing sight of the purpose. To be fair, if those 70,000 people all fly commercial, then their climate impact might not be too ludicrous. A first-class round trip from New York's JFK Airport to Dubai produces roughly 3 tons of carbon dioxide emissions per passenger. According to a UN calculator, that's less than a quarter of the carbon pollution the average American produces in a year. Flying economy cuts that impact in half yet again. By comparison, Taylor Swift's private jet flights produce nearly 8,300 tons of CO2 in 2022, by one estimate. Then again, 70,000 people producing 210,000 tons of CO2 for one Dubai shindig is the equivalent of more than 25 Taylor Swift years. And untold scores of those COP attendees won't be flying commercial. They'll be taking private jets, which generate 100 times more carbon pollution per passenger than commercial ones. The standard defense to such excess is that to get very important people to very important talks, you might have to accept a risk that as less important people will suffer a bit more sea level rise, drought, or wildfire in the future. And as climate talks have become more complicated, they have naturally required more bodies to work on them. This year's COP won't just be haggling over words like down and out. It will also involve detailed negotiations over climate finance and a stock take, accounting of exactly how far the world has come in fighting climate change. Spoiler alert, not very. It might also involve fossil fuel companies pledging to end methane emissions by 2030, which would actually be a huge development. Still, if these meetings are to be constructive in the future, then they'll need to consider bloat. In 2021 study, the European Capacity Building Initiative, a group focused on making climate talks less terrible, suggested pruning COPs back to 5,000 people, doing the boring technical work of putting treaties into action. Other businesses could be spread across smaller confabs throughout the year. The ECBI suggested including a Global Climate Action Week that would fulfill humanity's need for dog and pony shows attracting the world leaders, celebrities, and grifters currently turning COP into green Davos. That still sounds like a lot of flying, unfortunately, but maybe it would be more productive too. All right, what else do we need to take a look at here? Let's take a look at the weather forecast here. Today, it will be a high of 39 degrees, and then tonight, it will be 21 degrees. Wednesday, it starts to warm up, but not for too long. Wednesday, it'll be partly sunny and breezy, a high of 45, a low of 34. Thursday, yet warmer, turning sunny and breezy, high of 56, a low of 38. Friday will be our topper, mild with clouds and sun, a high of 52, a low of 30 degrees, and then it starts to cool off some. A little rain possibly on Saturday evening, and the temperature will be a high of 41 and a low of 23 degrees. National forecast, a storm will bring snow from Wisconsin through southern Michigan as rain mixes in front of from a northeastern Illinois through western Pennsylvania today. Rain showers will expand further southward through eastern Kentucky. The southeast will continue to be dry. The storm will continue to impact the northwest with heavy rain along the coast. So some people are asking about why is it so warm? Well, yes, of course, it is climate change. That's certainly part of it. But the other thing to keep in mind is El Nino. And that gets kind of complicated to explain. But the meteorologists have been saying that we are in what is called a classic El Nino weather pattern, which is causing the kind of crazy weather that we already are having. All right, let's now turn to the remaining time that we have here. 360 degrees section of the paper. It's the National and World Report section. Now, let's see what we've got here. I don't have too much time, but I am going to read this front, this main page. What happens if Trump is convicted of a crime? This is New York. Republican National Committee rules for next year's nominating contest and convention have been released without addressing a question the GOP could well face next summer. Can the party's delegate vote for a different candidate if the presumptive nominee is convicted of a felony? Former President Donald Trump is under four criminal indictments that will proceed through the GOP primary season, an overlap of legal and political calendars with no precedent in American politics. 15 states and American Samoa hold their GOP primaries on March 5th, known as Super Tuesday, which is also the day after his first trial is scheduled to begin in Washington on charges that he unlawfully sought to overturn the 2020 election. Trump is dominating the Republican field and may secure much of the support he needs by Super Tuesday, by which time almost half of the delegates who select the nominee at the GOP convention will have been awarded. Even if he were to be convicted in Washington or another trial, top party leaders and many voters have indicated that they would stand by Trump anyway. And Trump and his allies are pushing to dismiss and delay the trials and have worked with state parties to craft rules favorable to him. The RNC rule don't include any provisions specific to the unprecedented scenario unfolding. Bound delegates must vote for a particular presidential candidate at the convention based on the results of the primary or caucus at their state. As in past years, every state party must bind its delegates to vote for their assigned candidates during at least the first round of voting at the national convention, with limited exceptions for a smaller number of delegates. A candidate wins the nomination if they clinch a majority, which is 1,215 delegates. At next year's convention, which starts July 15th in Milwaukee, there will be opportunities to tweak the rules when they are adopted or suspended then, which can require two-thirds of delegates to approve on a vote. It's a parliamentary body, said Benjamin Ginsburg, a Republican election lawyer. It can always work its will if it wants to be one way or another. Such last-minute maneuvers are difficult to organize, and there are a few current signs that delegates might look for another option, even with Trump's criminal cases looming. They're all going to be chosen at contests in which people are voting for Trump, and I think they're unlikely, if he wins the primary, to change up because of a court case. The Trump campaign issued a preemptive warning anyway. And it does go on, but we have run out of time, folks. So I'd like to first remind you that you've been listening to IRIS, the Iowa Reading Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. I am your host, Peter Welch, and we have been talking or reading the e-edition of the Courier for Tuesday, December 5th. And thank you so much for listening. We'll talk again soon. Take care, everybody, and bye-bye now.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.